Hello there. Today is Wednesday, October 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the funerals begin for Jewish congregants murdered in their Pittsburgh synagogue, the Muslim community shows solidarity.
We want the Jewish community to know that we're very happy that they're here.
President Trump proposes a controversial new policy on immigration that could require a constitutional amendment. Also ahead, an alarming report about the future of wildlife on planet Earth. It's all on today's International Edition. One stone and one white rosebud for each victim. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump paid homage Tuesday to each of the 11 people slain in the worst instance of anti-Semitic violence in American history, as the Trumps placed their tributes outside the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, hundreds of demonstrators assembled for a unity rally. Many spoke of their displeasure with Trump's presence, some carrying signs that said, quote, hate has no home in Squirrel Hill.
I think the president's visit was very much a distraction. I think it detracts from our ability as a neighborhood to go and mourn, right? We've been doing that for a couple days now, and all of a sudden, because the president wants to come, you have to close the streets and nobody else can come. We had funerals today, and we would like to go back to mourning.
While Trump traveled to the historic hub of the city's Jewish community as the first funerals were held for the victims, who range in age from 54 to 97. The dead include a set of brothers, a husband and wife, professors, dentists, and a physician known for being accessible for friendship and medical advice around the clock.
I went to him about a month ago just for a regular checkup, and he asked how my mom was doing. He knew my mom lives in Kentucky. He said, and how's your mom now? And I said, she passed. And he held my hand and just cried with me over my mom passing.
Jewish funerals, like other religions, are steeped in tradition, ritual, and ceremony, and that includes preparing the dead for burial. Joining us now is David Zinner, Executive Director of Kivod Vernichon, which means honor and comfort. He was in Pittsburgh to offer assistance. Thank you for being with us. So tell us exactly what your organization does and has been doing.
Our organization is a North American organization, covers the U.S. and Canada. And we provide education and resources to Jewish groups that do the rituals around what happens after a person dies. We wash them, we dress them, we put them in a casket, and it's done by volunteers. And we support them with education, resources. We do everything we can to help them.
Are these rituals traditional for all sectors of Judaism?
The rituals that we do are standard for all branches of Judaism. They were first codified in about the 1600s, and Orthodox, conservative, Reform, Reconstructionists do the rituals pretty much exactly the same.
And can you briefly tell me what all those rituals are?
The rituals include first gathering together volunteers from the community and saying prayers for the person and asking God to treat them gently and to remember the good things they did in their lives, to wash their bodies carefully and respectfully, and to dress them in burial garments. And we do, in between the dressing and the washing, a ritual purification with water, and then we put them in the casket and close the lid.
And when you say you wash the body, what is the significance of that?
Well, we're preparing people to go before God, a judgment, and we want them to be clean, and we want them to be dressed in a way that is simple and respectful. They don't have any pockets because you can't carry anything with you. They don't have any metal. They're all simple, plain, biodegradable, environmentally friendly garments.
You went to Pittsburgh. Whatever you are able to tell us about what you experienced with the people that are having to deal with the processes involved in these funerals for the victims of this horrific shooting, tell us whatever you're able to tell us about what you experienced.
The group that does this ritual washing and purification called Sahara is made up of volunteers. and they did the washing for three men last night and two additional men this morning, and it was pretty rough for them. You know, they're not used to dealing with bullets and gunshot wounds and, you know, lots of blood. The typical death is a person who dies of old age in a hospital or a nursing home. So it was difficult physically because of blood and everything they had to deal with. It was difficult emotionally because of the situation. And to compound it, it was still more difficult because it's a very small community and everyone knew everyone. So they knew the people they were caring for. They knew them well. They've known them for a long time. And to still make it more difficult, some of these people were folks who were volunteers on this committee who they had worked with to wash other people and to dress other people. So it was an extremely difficult and just an awful experience. At the same time, while these folks are dedicated to creating something sacred out of the profane.
Well, meanwhile, the Muslim community in Pittsburgh and around the country have also been offering an enormous amount of support. Earlier, I spoke with Wazi Muhammad, executive director of the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh, and also executive director of a Muslim political advocacy organization, which has been raising thousands of dollars for victims' families. Thank you for talking to us. Tell us how you came to offer all this assistance.
When I first heard about it, it was shocking. It was really difficult to see. And we just wanted to figure out what we could do about it. I had my phone was filled with phone calls and messages from the Muslim community saying, like, where can we go? What can we do? Is there a link to donate? And, you know, so then I went to the scene and was with the community and was with the leaders as we were trying to figure out what was happening. And I went back to start LaunchGood, you know, like which is a Muslim crowdfunding platform. And I saw that Celebrate Mercy and Tariq al-Masidi and the Empower Change with Linda Sarsour already started one. You know, Muslims around the country felt for this community. Mm. You know, they're our neighbors, they're our family. We know them.
Mm-hmm.
We obviously wanted to fundraise, but it was really important that these Muslims around the entire country also felt the same way, and we just coordinated a campaign together. We all joined together to support this community, and it was a beautiful thing to see.
I know your original goal was something like 25,000, and you've well exceeded that.
Yeah, I think it's, say the last time we checked, it's around 200,000.
That's incredible. And just that it's a Muslim-led campaign. Is there a message behind what you're doing?
Obviously, the basics are we wanted to come make sure that it's a terrible time, it's a horrible, horrific act, that the family doesn't have to worry about anything but grieving and mourning. Don't worry about money. We never want them to see a bill. And we're going to make sure that's the case. So that was part of it. But the other part is that this individual came in, you know, hatred in his heart and tried to make them feel like they didn't belong in this community. And everything we do moving forward is just to show them that that's not the case. We're the least likely people to show them that. And I think that's the best thing possible. So as many people as we can in the Pittsburgh area, around the country, we want the Jewish community to know that we're very happy that they're here. There are, you know, Abrahamic cousins. They're actually our family. We're very similar in traditions and the history in the United States. And we want them here. Pittsburgh's better for it. Pennsylvania's better for it. The country's better for it.
It is interesting that both religions have been persecuted and vilified.
Yeah.
The shared humanity here is just incredible.
It's an unfortunate club that we're in, but we do understand, you know, when you vilify a community, that this kind of rhetoric and negative speech leads to negative actions against our communities. And then we saw it happen with them, but we very much understand it considering what's been happening to the Muslim community, you know, in the last couple of decades.
The funds that you're raising will go to help the families of the victims and survivors. Is that what I'm understanding?
Correct. That's exactly where it's going. Yep.
Have you also met with any of the local rabbis or any of the families?
Absolutely. You know, I've been meeting with the rabbis all day. We had the two of the funerals, unfortunately. I mean, we have to do them more today. Dr. Jerry Rabinowitz, the one who did amazing work, you know, accepting HIV/AIDS community, you know, before anybody else would allow them into their clinics as a family doctor. He did that, which is really important. And then there is also Cecil and David Rosenthal. Their funeral was here as well today. So we had those and we were all together. The Muslims came in support of the Jewish community. And then from there, you know, we gathered outside a Tree of Life. And from there, we started to march from Forbes and Beechwood all the way to Murray and Forbes. You know, so like I'm really still at that. You know, so since 8 a.m. in the morning, I've been with the Jewish community. We'll be there tomorrow and the next day and the next day until as long as they need it.
Well, the shooting has touched many across the nation and even the world, with many communities holding interfaith services to support the people struggling to understand how it could have happened. And joining us is Rabbi Stuart Weinblatt, founder of Congregation B'nai Tzedek in Potomac, Maryland. You held a service Tuesday night. Hundreds attended. Tell us about it.
We opened up our congregation to members of our congregational community, and we had an overflowing service of over 300 people. Members of our synagogue came, but also members of the general community. There were people from the Mormon Church who wanted to come. We had also individuals from the People's Baptist Church of Silver Spring, which is an African-American church with whom we have had exchange program. They came, as did their pastor. The county executive was here and also a representative of the Embassy of Israel. It was quite an outpouring of people who just, and it's obviously we only sent out notice. People had at the most 36 hours notice, and yet it was standing room only.
I take it you don't normally have a service on Tuesday evening?
We would not have had the service that we had tonight. It was a combination of a service and a vigil, specifically because of what happened in Pittsburgh.
And I imagine the reason so many people from across religions and ethnicities showed up was because this really has struck a note with people from all walks of life.
It was unbelievable, just to have people there. One of the things I mentioned when I spoke was that when I was at the grocery store earlier today wearing my head covering, my yarmulke, the woman who was the cashier made a point of just expressing her sympathy to me, to our community on our loss, and the person behind her also just spontaneously reached out his hand and said the same thing. So unfortunately, anti-Semitism is not new. And unfortunately, attacks and assaults on Jews is not new. But as I emphasized in my remarks, what is new and what is different is the outpouring of support and sympathy from the community that we receive at a time such as this. And that is very, very gratifying.
What did you say to offer solace, comfort, and even hope?
Well, one of the things that I reminded people of was that the history of our people is such that there have always been those who have sought to take the lives of Jews, and that there are, unfortunately, all too many times in our history when that has happened. But that the response is one which is most important. And the response is a response of hope and of maintaining our faith so that we not let those who want to extinguish the light of Judaism and those who want to murder Jews be victorious. So my message was very much that we have prevailed, we have survived, and we will continue to survive.
The fact that you had this interfaith service, that so many people wanted to be there and gather, it would almost seem as if that's the opposite impact that the killer wanted.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things I mentioned, when the killer was in the hospital, the gentleman who was the head of the hospital made a point of going up to him and introduced himself to him. And he said, "I'm the head of the hospital. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Cohen," obviously a Jewish name and a Jewish man.
Well, thanks for being with us and sharing your story. Funerals for the other victims continue through the week. Well, with less than a week to go before a crucial U.S. midterm congressional election, Americans are on edge after the massacre at the synagogue and the arrest of a man charged with sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats. Voters will elect a new Congress on November 6th, and the result could change or shift the balance of power in Washington and have a profound impact on the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the final days of the midterm campaign from Washington.
In Pittsburgh, a tearful vigil for the victims of the mass shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue. From President Trump, a condemnation of violence and a plea for unity.
We condemn the historic evil of anti-Semitism and every other form of evil. And unfortunately, evil comes in many forms. And we come together as one American people.
The synagogue shooting and the arrest of a man charged with sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats and Trump critics have heightened tensions and uncertainty in the final days of the midterm campaign, says analyst John Hudak.
Well, the country is in pain. This is a set of circumstances that unfortunately happens in America all too regularly. That is acts of violence and acts of aggression toward fellow Americans by Americans.
Hey, folks, how are you?
Former Vice President Joe Biden is among those calling for calm.
I know sometimes these days the anger, the hatred, the viciousness seem like they're going to overwhelm us. And it's on our leaders to set the tone, to dial down the temperature, to restore some dignity to our national dialogue.
A vote for Democrats is also a vote to destroy Medicare.
Some Democrats say the president's partisan attacks have contributed to the politically charged atmosphere. Not true, says White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders.
The very first thing the media did was blame the president and make him responsible for these ridiculous acts. That is outrageous that would be the very first reaction.
For his part, Trump has vowed to campaign aggressively right up to Election Day on issues important to his supporters, like immigration.
The Democrat Party is openly encouraging millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and bankrupt our country. That's what has to happen.
I did 50 town halls. You know what people talked about in those town halls? Health care.
Democrats have focused on health care for much of the campaign, but Trump also looms large, says Jim Kessler.
Democrats want to make this about health care and the tax bill and about Donald Trump. And let's face it, this is going to be about Donald Trump.
You all ready?
Democrats expect to make gains in the House of Representatives, but Republicans are favored to hold their narrow majority in the Senate, says John Fortier.
And some of what has happened in recent days with the Kavanaugh hearings and Republicans kind of coming home as a party are helping in that area. So it'll be mostly a win for Democrats, but with a probably bright spot in the Senate for Republicans.
The stakes are enormous. A Democratic House could block the Trump agenda and launch numerous investigations of the Trump White House, complicating the president's re-election hopes in 2020. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A report says the Saudi hired lobbyists have been giving millions to influence U.S. Congress. Cambodian Americans flex a long silent voice in the U.S. midterm elections. Turkey presses Saudi Arabia to reveal who sent a journalist's killers. And the FBI is looking into an apparent effort to smear special counsel Robert Mueller. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thousands of U.S. troops have been deployed along the U.S. southern border with Mexico to stop what President Donald Trump has called an invasion of migrants. He also wants to end so-called birthright citizenship, which grants citizenship to anyone born in America regardless of legal status. With his eyes squarely on next Tuesday's elections, the president is rushing out hardline immigration declarations, promises, and actions as he tries to mobilize supporters to retain Republican control of Congress. Trump said he will send troops to the Mexican border to help defend against caravans of Central American migrants who are on foot in Mexico, hoping to make the U.S. border and seek asylum. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Jennifer McCoy, political science professor at Georgia State University and former director of the Americas at the Carter Center, whether the troop deployment is actually an extraordinary move.
Well, it certainly is, because in the United States, we've traditionally relied on National Guard for any kind of internal order situation. Now, this is at the border, people seeking to cross, some of them to request asylum, which is a legal move, coming through the legal ports. Others may seek to cross outside of the legal port. But this is, you know, quite unusual for, I don't remember ever seeing this in my lifetime, sending troops to the border like this to stop immigrants coming from seeking a legal entry into the country.
Is this because immigration laws are considered, as the president indicates, weak?
Well, the president is making immigration a big political issue right now before the midterms, and he believes that this is the way he can energize his base to vote and the way to win. And so he's focusing on it now, in particular, before the midterms, and continues to talk about it for political agenda and to distract attention from other kinds of messages. The Democrats, on the other hand, are trying to focus on health care, and make that their primary message. So that's the reason, I think, for this focus. The caravan happens to be coming at this point in time, but immigrants are coming, you know, regularly into the United States. This is overall a relatively small number, and overall immigration has dropped in recent years of people seeking to enter the United States, and border apprehensions have dropped as well. So it is not the crisis, the alarming crisis, that I think the president is trying to make it out to be.
Does the politicization of this matter extend to his proposal for ending birthright citizenship?
Well, the timing of that, again, in the week before the election, I think is driven by electoral calendar. And so to float that he could do this by executive fiat is quite an out-of-the-box idea that most legal analysts, you know, do not agree with. And so it seems to be, you know, clearly more messaging to try to assuage the concerns of his primary voters. And for this particular time, I imagine that we will not see much actual action happening with this particular proposal when it's, you know, clearly analyzed that it will be, I think, extremely unlikely that there would be legal approval to do it in this way, to change the Constitution by executive fiat.
President indicates that the migrant caravan members, if they do reach the U.S. border, will be provided tent cities, apparently along the border, until their asylum cases are adjudicated. Is this extraordinary?
Well, in the past, they have been allowed to come into the country, make their asylum claims, and remain in the country while those asylum claims are assessed. So keeping them outside the country would be new. Now, of course, under this administration, they have been allowed to come in up until now, those who were allowed to come in. Not many of them have been turned back as well, but those who were allowed to come in and then detained. And so that was a new step as well, detaining them rather than processing those who requested asylum and keeping track of them while they were free to, you know, to be on their own accord, awaiting their asylum claim. So yes, it seems to be each step of the way getting a new tactic that is a more restrictive tactic.
All right, that's Jennifer McCoy, political science professor at Georgia State University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A just-released report from the World Wildlife Fund details a rapid decline in the world's biodiversity. In general, the percentages of all kinds of animals in the land, sea, and air have declined rapidly since 1970. VOA's Kevin Enochs reports.
The statistics are stark and alarming.
Populations of mammals, of birds, of fish declined between 1970 and the year 2014 by 60% globally. And in freshwater habitats, the figure is some 83%.
And it's no surprise that human activity is mainly to blame.
Human activity is the driver of the declines we're seeing, primarily our demand, our increasing demand for food, energy, water.
That activity is driving climate change, but the authors say there are lessons we can learn from how the world came together to act on curbing greenhouse gases.
When we think about how the world responded to the climate threat and forged a pact in Paris in 2015 to address climate change, we need a similar deal at the global level for people and nature.
And Cesario points to success stories like the giant panda's recovery and the rising population of tigers in the wild as proof that what is happening is reversible.
The report is very sobering. I think the message is also that it's not too late to course correct. Life is resilient, it bounces back, and so if we take concerted action, we can reverse these trends and ensure a living planet for future generations.
To help life bounce back, the World Wildlife Fund is calling on governments to sign onto a Convention on Biological Diversity in 2020. It creates a pathway to conserve the world's wild places and reverse the planet's shrinking biodiversity.
And it has set targets for things like percentage of area to be protected under parks and indigenous reserves and other types of community conserved areas.
The WWF says all of the resources the Earth provides us in terms of food, lumber, and energy, for instance, all told are worth about $125 trillion a year. The goal now is to find a way to make all that rich natural biodiversity sustainable and available for generations to come. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, the film Vaya from Nigerian-born director Akin Omotoso tells the story of three people who journey from their rural homes in South Africa to Johannesburg. As Michael Sullivan reports, it's a story of migration that deals with universal themes.
It is a story of lost innocence and betrayal.
Vaya tells the story of three strangers who get on a train, each of them with a mission to fulfill in Johannesburg. They're coming from Durban to Johannesburg. They never meet, but their stories are intertwined.
Each traveler has a mission, and each faces rejection, abuse, or violence. This coming-of-age film originated from real stories of South Africans in the Homeless Writers Project, a workshop for people living on the streets. Vaya means to go in the dialect of South African townships.
It takes on several meanings. So to go, they're leaving Durban to go to Johannesburg, but then when you get there, you know, maybe people don't want you to leave, so they want you to go, you know. So it really covers the, I'll say, the spirit of the projects.
Omotoso is a migrant himself. He was born in Nigeria, but his family moved to South Africa, where he studied drama. Then he worked as an actor and director. Vaya is one of 20 films from filmmakers of color and women directors distributed by Array, an arts collective and distribution company founded by Hollywood filmmaker Ava DuVernay.
Our purpose is to make sure that audiences have access to films they otherwise would not see, those independent voices that deserve a platform for stories to be told.
Vaya has played at international festivals and opened at theaters in the United States in October. It will also stream on Netflix starting November 1st. The director says this South Africa-based film tells a story that many can relate to.
I always say everyone has a cousin who's arriving, or a brother who's leaving, or somebody who's coming. So Vaya is able to tap into, I guess, something that doesn't just happen in Johannesburg.
It taps into universal themes, adds the director, the search for a better life and the struggle for survival. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London, hoping you have a wonderful day.